I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and with one day left, both presidential candidates are logging a lot of miles. John McCain is stumping in seven states, including Pennsylvania, Indiana, New Mexico, and Florida, and Barack Obama is touching down in Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. Well, tonight, both are scheduled to appear during Monday Night Football halftime via satellite, so no chance they'll suddenly take their battle to the field. Although, at this point, they may prefer a scrimmage to resolve certain battleground states. Let's start today with our audio postcard from New Hampshire, once granite solid Republican, now battleground. We visited our neighbors to the north during the pivotal primary last January and returned this past weekend to two gathering spots where we found, at first, the same partisan divide that exists across the country. We started at the Tilton Diner in Tilton, New Hampshire.
One egg scrambled with home fries and sausage and dry wheat toast.
I'm voting for McCain. I mean, I'm just not ready for as much change as, you know, Obama thinks he's going to send this way and tax, tax, tax.
Well, he says he's going to only raise the taxes on families over 250.
Well, do you honestly believe that? Kind of scares me.
I'm going Democratic all the way, and my reasons are, how's your stock, how's the jobs, you know, the working person, they're the ones that need the tax break, not the ones that earn a lot of money.
Yeah, and you trust that Barack Obama will give that break to people who make under 250?
I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, but most definitely I've seen what the Republicans have done in the past, and I'm not interested.
It seems to be a family here.
Yes.
Have you made up your mind for Tuesday?
Barack Obama. I just like him. I don't like John McCain, what he stands for, and I don't like Sarah Palin.
I'm going to vote for McCain Palin.
Uh-huh.
I love Palin. I connect with her because I feel like I could go up and talk to her. You know, she seems like one of us.
But far more interesting and more frequent than the committed voters were the undecided voters at one table, two couples.
Exactly what I am. I
really?
Still haven't decided yet. I'm independent.
What do you need to hear?
I'm going to retire shortly, and I heard nothing from anybody that would guarantee Social Security. I mean, I worked hard all my life, and I have a 401k that's lost thousands of dollars.
I'm looking for topics of issues for the elderly. I work with elderly people. More Medicare and Medicaid, what the cutbacks are going to be, how it's going to affect them. So that's where I'm on the fence right now. So I've been going online to see what they're supporting, what they're not supporting. That will sway me for my vote one way or the other, how it's going to affect the elderly.
Back in the kitchen, an older dishwasher seemed genuinely pained by his indecision.
I'm not sure which one I'm going to vote for yet. I ain't too fond of Obama. He's got a bad history, I think. I probably would end up voting for him if I do vote, though.
Is part of that he's unfamiliar to you? Is it yes? You say yes?
It's nothing to do with what he is, because I'm not prejudiced. It's just a tough decision, that's all.
The short order cook was angry.
Have you got your candidate picked?
I'm really not decided yet.
What aren't you hearing?
I'm a new house owner. I was responsible enough to go out and do the right thing. You know, pick a fixed mortgage, something I can afford. And now these people are getting, you know, bailed out that, you know, weren't responsible. And you know, what are they going to do for me? I'm angry. I think there's a lot of people that are angry. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm undecided.
If you want, you can grab the booth right over there. I'll be right with you.
Back in the dining area, 320-somethings crowd into a booth, their college yearbooks open. They're holding a mini reunion over eggs and hash browns.
I don't really know who I'm officially voting for right now.
What haven't you heard that's pushed you definitively?
I think I've heard too much, and it's just sorting through everything right now.
Who are you voting for?
I'm voting for McCain.
What pulls you towards McCain?
Tax policy. If you allow the upper classes to have money, they'll create jobs. They either put it into a bank, which the bank will then loan out to someone, or they'll spend it, which helps stimulate the economy.
You're African-American.
That's correct. That's
yes.
True. It is on the radio, so this
what?
Is true. But some people, I know they can't tell, but it's...
You're stunned.
Is that a conflict or a poll right there, you think?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A fair question. That's a fair question, because I've always been a big fan of Barack Obama for years. I mean, these guys, you know, 4 years ago I was talking about this guy. There's a black guy in Illinois. It's a senator. It's the first one since 1877 or something. It's crazy. it's not an easy choice to vote against him. I would really love to vote for him, but I don't agree with his, you know, finance policy. I couldn't in good conscience vote for him. And if he wins, I mean, a lot of our friends are these big-time, huge, hardcore right-wing Republicans and stuff like that. You know, it's like, oh, the end of the world is coming if Obama's like the president. The Statue of Liberty is going to crumble. You know, the Democrat, the Republicans, we know what is going to fall apart. Yeah, that's crazy talk. No matter who wins, the country's going to be fine.
Come on in.
Our stop number two, about 20 minutes from the Tilton Diner, is the White Clapboard Country Store in bucolic Canterbury, New Hampshire. It's owned by the residents and run by self-described reflexive Republican Tony Halla.
That's what I call reflexive Republican.
Reflexive Republican, that's what Tony calls herself. Yeah, less charitable people call it knee-jerk.
knee-jerk, jack, bullshit.
Oh, God.
Tony represents the so-called Rockefeller Republicans, fiscally conservative, less so on social issues, once as bedrock as granite in this state, but given our unscientific sampling, increasingly replaced by Democrats. Take Bud Phelan.
I really think we need some change, very serious stuff, and probably a little more, I hate to use the word socialistic, but I think there is a social responsibility that's not being met.
But you know, that's where McCain and Palin are ripping into Barack Obama. They're calling him a socialist, even though it isn't socialism, but it is spreading the wealth a little.
There's nothing wrong with that. You can't 1% have a lot of it, and lots of people don't. By the way, I've had a good life. I can work. I'm healthy. We just need to take care of everybody a little better. I think we can. I think we can do a little better.
Boy, I got to ask Tony about that. Hey, Tony.
You might remember we spoke with Toni during the primaries when she complained about the store's food drive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They kept bugging me with the canned food for the homeless. And finally I said, I don't care about the homeless. I'm a Republican. What? Leave me alone. You know. So, of course, then, surreptitiously, I brought in the canned food the next day.
Yes, a lot of what goes on here is everyone working hard to live up to their caricature. But Toni can also be counted on to give us her honest and frank opinions. Opinions that may be endangered, but are still a part of the political landscape.
I grew up in the 50s, of course. Eisenhower was in the White House. All was right with the world, and he's an old white guy. So I'm comfortable with an old white guy. And then we had Reagan and Bush Sr., old white guys. So I gravitate to what I know. What is McCain? An old white guy.
What's familiar to you?
Yes. And I make no bones about that. No. I don't like change. I'm terrified of change, especially politically.
Yeah. Was McCain conservative enough for you?
No. No. I'm settling.
Conservative, knee-jerk Republican. That's what she is.
You got it all. Why would I not vote for a white guy?
Because it's familiar to you.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
So, but are you voting also against a black guy?
No, I'm voting against a Democrat. And would I vote against a black guy? That's very interesting. And nowadays, one has to think twice anymore. I suppose I would. Yeah, I might. I might.
Because?
I try very hard to be a redneck.
Now, are you putting me on here, or is this...
No, but I'm comfortable in my rigidity, so I think an Asian guy or anybody that's not a white, avuncular, experienced... Yeah. I used to say to people, if you're on a desert island, you wash up, and you see a bunch of white guys, you see a bunch of Asians, you see a bunch of whatever, you're going to go to the white guys. Because that's what you're... Yes, exactly. I'm going to go right to the white guys because we gravitate to what we know, I think.
As we left the Canterbury Country Store, the spirited and honest debate continued.
Experiment. Life on Earth was a nice experiment. 7 billion people. How are we going to get them all on the same page? We're not. Even Jefferson said it was a noble experiment.
We'll do what we can on Tuesday. That's all we can do. And then we'll be able to complain because we voted.
The always lively Canterbury Country Store and Post Office. Well, let's turn now to Rob Christensen, chief political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer in North Carolina and author of the book The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics. Rob, North Carolina, also a toss-up. You write, it's never seen an election like this. 2.5 million or 41% of registered North Carolinians have already voted, and indications are that they're leaning Obama. What does that mean for John McCain?
On Tuesday, it's likely to be a little bit stronger McCain turnout because that's partly the way that two parties have have worked here. The Republicans have more targeted the election day as opposed to early voting.
So don't trust the early returns.
Well, they certainly are optimistic from an Obama point of view, and so Democrats are very excited. But the counting's not even close to being done, obviously. So this is a razor's edge race right now. It really could go either way. It's extraordinary that the race would be this close in North Carolina, which has not gone for a Democrat since Jimmy Carter in 1976. And it's extraordinary that in a southern state, an African-American man from Chicago would be going toe-to-toe with John McCain. And this is and particularly in a state that has a very strong military tradition, lots of military bases, lots of military retirees. It's the kind of state that John McCain should be doing well in, given his background and his views. But the economy here has been really shaken, and not only the old industries are hurting, like textiles and tobacco and furniture, but the new industries have been shaken, like Wachovia Bank in Charlotte, which is one of the major banks in the state, and that just was taken over, merged with Wells Fargo. And so there's a lot of economic unsettled times here in the state, and that's certainly working for Obama.
Rob Christensen, chief political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer in North Carolina. Rob, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's bring in now Joe Froelich, associate editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. Joe, the latest Quinnipiac poll shows Obama with a 7% lead in Ohio. At the end of last week, McCain traveled all around the state on a two-day bus tour. 80,000 people turned out to hear Obama speak in Cleveland yesterday. So what's it like on the ground there? Can Obama be beaten there?
I think it's reasonably close, but I do think that Obama certainly got the advantage. Both the Columbus Dispatch, which does a mail poll, which everybody will tell you shouldn't work, but historically it has. It's got a pretty accurate record. They've got him up by 6. The Ohio poll, which has a good track record in the state, has him up by 6. Now, there is actually one poll, though, a new poll out over the weekend that had McCain up by 2. And that's the Mason-Dixon poll, who we've used in the past, and they've been pretty accurate as well. But Mason-Dixon stopped polling, I believe, on Thursday night, whereas the other two were polling through yesterday. So I'm inclined to think that Obama has the edge. I mean, both of them and a couple of other ones have him over 50%, which is sort of the magic number, obviously.
Biggest issue, the economy?
Clearly. Ohio's, the median income here has actually dropped during this decade. We've lost about 300,000 manufacturing jobs. We never really recovered from the recession at the beginning of the decade, the post 9/11 one, too. Mm-hmm. And then to get hit with this, and the foreclosure issue has hit really, really hard here, especially in Cleveland, Youngstown, the big cities of the state. But throughout Ohio, we've been really hard hit by the foreclosure issue, the subprime.
Joe Froelich, associate editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other battleground states, Virginia, Indiana, NBC has just added Montana and North Dakota, and some analysts are even saying they're going to keep an eye on South Carolina. South Carolina, the home of the late Strom Thurmond. We're going to hear a little bit more about that later. Also later in the show, the battle for control of Congress. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. Let's get the view now from Alaska, which Sarah Palin famously said looked out at Russia. But Alaskans are now peering into their future and looking at one of the most pivotal elections in the state's history. Of course, Alaskans are deciding whether to send their governor to Washington. They're also deciding whether or not to end two long political careers, that of Senator Ted Stevens, who represented Alaska for 40 years in Washington, and Representative Don Young, who's been in D.C. for 36 years. Both are behind in the polls. As the state faces a dramatic fall in oil revenues. Well, Michael Carey is in Anchorage, where he hosts Alaska Public Television's Anchorage Edition and writes a column for the Anchorage Daily News. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Michael, and when we spoke shortly after the Republican convention, Sarah Palin had approval ratings of 80% or more in Alaska. They've since fallen. She's making a 4,500-mile detour to come home to vote tomorrow. How will Alaskans receive her? How do they see her today?
Well, she will be spending most of her time, or the brief time that she's here before she goes to Arizona to join John McCain, in Wasilla with her friends, neighbors, and supporters. And I'm confident she'll be very well received by those people who were her base, really. Mm-hmm. That's who she's going to be meeting with.
But how about people who maybe weren't her supporters and are looking at her campaign?
Well, I think that the polling data clearly demonstrates there's a great deal more skepticism towards Governor Palin than there was before. At the convention and afterwards, she picked several fights with the Democrats, both nationally when she tried to link Obama to domestic terrorists, and here at home in the so-called Troopergate investigation into her behavior with her former brother-in-law, in which her spokesman really vilified some of the Democrats who were involved with that investigation. I think this is really going to hurt.
Well, and now Alaskans are hearing national jokes about aerial hunting and Wasilla. It's being called a soulless town without sidewalks.
has gone there several times, and we all look like we're pretty primitive, I think you'd say.
Well, but on the other hand, the Tourism Bureau in Alaska has received double the calls since her pick, so it has been good, too, for the state. Well, let's take a look at the state's future, given what's happening elsewhere in the voting tomorrow. A third of Alaska's economic base is dependent on federal dollars. Half the price of oil is the other resource for the state. The price of oil is half what it was during the summer. What happens if Senator Stevens or the congressman there, Don Young, aren't sent back to Washington to bring home some of those federal dollars?
Well, there are a couple things. First, the oil price decline. It is half of what it was when Sarah Palin left for the convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. And the oil pays 85% of our state budget. So we're going to have some, I wouldn't say necessarily an immediate day of reckoning, but the governor is going to be faced with some very hard decisions very quickly on oil. Federal dollars have been critical to Alaska. We receive more than any other state, but Virginia usually annually. And a lot of that has been through seniority in Congress, which is what makes that system work. Now, with the bailout and all the financial problems the country is facing, the country as a whole may not have a lot of money to spend on earmarks, and certainly earmarks are in decline. But with new legislators or new lawmakers in Washington, we would have a very different relationship with the federal government.
Well, Senator Stevens was just convicted on corruption charges. Don Young, the representative, is under a cloud of possible corruption charges. Very briefly, do people worry that the Democrat challengers, Ethan Berkowitz and Mark Begich, are going to be newbies if they go back to Washington, new at that skill of bringing home federal dollars?
There is a substantial part of the electorate that worries about that kind of thing, and certainly Stevens and Young have played it up. At the same time, there are people here who realize it's time for a change. Senator Stevens is 84 years old. He's received nothing but bad publicity for the last 2.5 or 3 months. He was on television in a debate, which I participated in which he still maintains he's never been convicted of any crime. For Stevens and Young, it's a pretty desperate situation.
Mike Carey from Anchorage, where he hosts Alaska Public Television's Anchorage Edition and writes a column for the Anchorage Daily News and is watching with all Alaskans at tomorrow's important elections. Mike, thanks so much.
My pleasure. See you.
This weekend, a radio DJ from Montreal got Governor Palin on the phone by pretending to be French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Now, Marc-Antoine Audette and his colleague Sébastien Trudel worked for 5 days trying to get through to Palin. How they convinced her staffers they were the real deal, no one knows. But here is an excerpt of the 6-minute conversation that Sarah Palin was actually having with Canadian disc jockeys and thought she was having with French President Sarkozy.
Yes, hello, Mrs. Governor.
Hello, this is Sarah. How are you?
Fine, and you? This is Nicolas Sarkozy speaking. How are you?
Oh, so good. It's so good to hear you. Thank you for calling us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. We have such great respect for you, John McCain and I. We love you, and thank you for 2 minutes to talk to me.
Excellent. Are you confident?
Very confident, and we're thankful that polls are showing that the race is tightening. And
well, I know very well that the campaign can be exhausting. How do you feel right now, my dear?
I feel so good. I feel like we're in a marathon, and at the very end of the marathon, you get your second wind, and you plow through the finish.
You see, I got elected in France because I'm real, and you seem to be someone who's real as well.
Yes, yeah. Nicholas, we so appreciate this opportunity.
You know, I see you as a president one day, you too.
Maybe in 8 years.
You know, we have a lot in common because personally, one of my favorite activities is to hunt, too.
Oh, very good. We should go hunting together.
Exactly. We could go try hunting by helicopter like you did. I never did that. Like we say in French, on pourrait tuer des bébés phoques aussi.
Well, I think think we could have a lot of fun together as we're getting work done. We can kill two birds with one stone that way.
You know, we have a lot in common also, because except that from my house I can see Belgium. That's kind of less interesting than you.
Well, see, we're right next door to other countries that we all need to be working with. You know, I look forward to working with you and getting to meet you personally and your beautiful wife. Oh, my goodness. You've added a lot of energy to your country, even with that beautiful family of yours.
Thank you very much. You know, my wife, Carla, would love to meet you. You know, even though she was a bit jealous that I was supposed to speak to you today.
Well, give her a big hug from me.
Well, shortly after that, the prankster told the governor he really wasn't President Sarkozy. A Palin aide said, gotta go. Palin joins Mick Jagger, Britney Spears, Bill Gates, and Sarkozy himself, who've all been pranked by Marc-Antoine Audet. The Palin campaign laughed it off, saying, c'est la vie. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, of course, we'll take a look at how the election day is going, but also we'll look at the real madmen. These are the Madison Avenue executives who changed the way we sell things. Democrats are hoping to pull off an Election Day hat trick tomorrow, a trifecta of wins in the White House and both houses of Congress. The Democrats believe that 60 Senate seats might be within their grasp, and that's the magic number a party needs to become filibuster-proof. Analysts agree the Democrats could pick up 25 to 30 House seats. How did this happen when just 8 years ago Republicans were boasting of achieving permanent majority status, with Democrats holding fewer seats than at any time since the 1930s when Herbert Hoover was president? David Hawkins is managing editor of CQ Weekly. And David, you write that this election could be the biggest upset in the Senate since the 1980 Reagan landslide when the GOP picked up a dozen seats. So first of all, how many Senate seats do you see Democrats picking up?
Well, it looks like right now they have a lock to pick up four and then have a shot at picking up maybe four or maybe five more. That would take them from 51 to at least 55 and then 56, 57, 58, 59. It's looking at this hour, as we talk, it's less than a day to go till the polls open. It looks as though they're going to fall a hair short of the magic 60.
Well, and some people debate whether or not it's a good thing that one party holds all three of these houses, so to speak. That's an argument for another time. In the meantime, we want to see how they did it. Let's take a look in North Carolina, where Elizabeth Dole, Republican royalty, is struggling in her race with Democrat Kay Hagan. As you write, Kay Hagan was an obscure state senator who wasn't even the Democrats' first choice. Now, we've spoken on this program about an early ad from the Democrats that boosted Hagan. Our listeners in North Carolina are probably sick of it, but it was the two old actors in the rocking chairs who positioned Dole as ineffective, past her prime, and a carpetbagger. It worked. It was a successful ad. But most recently, there were the Dole ads that tried to paint Hagan as an atheist. Tell us about those ads.
Well, that's right. It used the phrase godless. It tried to link Kay Hagan with Godless Americans Political Action Committee, a civil liberties group that wants to have the phrase under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance and in God we trust removed from the currency. And it's backfired, I think, pure and simple. Kay Hagan has come back and essentially sued Liddy Dole for defamation, mainly to try and get the ad off the air. I'm not sure that that's worked. I think it's going down in North Carolina as something of a desperation ploy, and Liddy Dole's standing in the polls seems to be slipping by the hour.
And Kay Hagan, by the way, is a Christian and was a Sunday school teacher, so that's also come out because of the ad.
That's right. If anything, it's just allowed Kay Hagan to rebut this by introducing her own Christianity and her own religious faith into the race in a way that she wasn't really talking about up till then.
Well, let's take a look at another race. We understand that even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky is struggling to hold on to his seat. Tell us about his challenger.
His challenger is a man named Bruce Lunsford. He's the owner of a chain of nursing homes that has made him rich, and he's been willing to spend a bunch of his own money. He's run statewide a couple of times before and not won. They've been close races, and he's become well-known and is not disliked down there. And Mitch McConnell is tied to George Bush in a way that few other senators can claim to be. In other words, as the Senate Republican leader, it's been his job for the last 2 years to try and help George Bush win as much in the Senate as he possibly can. This has obviously given Bruce Lunsford a tailor-made issue to hang around the Senate Minority Leader's neck.
Well, the Democrats this time around also have some tough races, although analysts today are saying that Mary Landrieu in Louisiana looks a little safer than she has. Tim Mahoney in the House in Florida had that affair and scandal. Will he win re-election?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Tim Mahoney, you will remember, who only won 2 years ago because of another sex scandal, that one involving Republican Mark Foley and his inappropriate, at best, email conversations with House pages.
So the Democrats will drop some, but overall, they're looking at potential tremendous success. What do you think is behind it, besides Bush's negativity ratings and Obama's appeal?
What we at CQ have been watching for the last 2 years has been how Democratic campaign organizers, Howard Dean, Rahm Emanuel, those are two names people, your listeners may know, Rahm Emanuel, the former Clinton White House guy who then became the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and has now passed it on to another younger congressman. These people have been what we call expanding the playing field. They have been going into districts and states where the Republicans seem to have a lock and starting to build back the party, starting to recruit candidates.
Howard Dean called this the 50-state strategy, and you write that the notion of spending time and money trying to revive the Democrats in places like rural South Carolina was derided originally, but now we're hearing analysts just today saying they're going to be watching South Carolina very closely tomorrow night. South Carolina.
Right. South Carolina, reliably red at the presidential level, but the Democrats have a decent shot, a very decent shot, at picking up at least one and potentially two congressional seats in reliably rock-solid red South Carolina because they got people to run who were plausible, who were willing to spend some of their own money, who were willing to run in places where a strong African-American turnout to go out for Barack Obama could help. They planted the seeds early, and then when these races started to get a little bit competitive, they were able to pour some money in. It's essentially at the House level, like what we saw with Kay Hagan and the famous ad that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago. The two old guys in the rocking chairs was sort of venture capital. They tried to throw out that ad to see if it would work, and when it did, they had the money to put into it.
All right. How much money did the Democratic committee spend as opposed to the Republicans and, as you said, this seating?
The Democratic Senate group, even by the end of last month, which is the ones I'm looking at now, they'd spent $103 million. On the House side, $130 million. Which was essentially $30 million more than the Republicans had. So that's a lot of money.
30 Republican lawmakers in Congress are also leaving office, leaving seats open. And you talked about how the Democrats were so good at recruitment. The Republican political machine had trouble recruiting Republicans to take some of these slots that they knew were opening up. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's exactly right. And on both the House side and the Senate side, especially on the Senate side, there were plenty of Democrats running for re-election to the Senate this year in reliably Republican states. Montana's become competitive at the end presidentially, but Max Baucus, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, he's somebody that the Republicans would love to get rid of. Montana generally goes Republican, and they ended up not being able to find anybody to run against him. They ended up with a Green Party candidate who just decided to run in the Republican primary and won. Similarly, in South Dakota, a guy named Tim Johnson, who people may remember as the senator who had a near-fatal brain aneurysm, he only won the last time by about 500 votes, and he was seen as very vulnerable. Once he recovered from his brain aneurysm, all the top-tier Republican candidates that were going to run against him decided not to, that it would be perceived as almost vulture-like behavior, so they've got an obscure state rep, the only candidate they could find to run against him.
Well, but outside of that, David Hawkins, it seems as if after the dust settles tomorrow, there's going to be some thinking on the Republican side about finding the next generation of potential lawmakers.
Well, that's right. I think it does look, no matter what happens at the presidential level, the congressional campaign for the Republicans has been pretty bad, and there will be some serious soul-searching about whether they have done the right thing strategically, how they're going to go find money for 2010, what kind of candidates they're going to go after. It's essentially a similar situation about 20 years ago that gave rise to the famous Newt Gingrich, who was outside the party hierarchy but had some bright ideas about how to go after some of these seats. They eventually started listening to him. It took 4 to 6 years, but he won back Congress for the Republicans low these 15 years ago.
David Hawkins, managing editor of CQ Weekly. David, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, quick programming note. Later this week, we're going to speak to Joan Baez and also Greg McGuire, the author of Wicked, who now takes on the Cowardly Lion. Those are some stories we have coming for you in the coming week. And before we go today, a conversation with and the beautiful music of John Adams. You're listening to Here and Now. Pity people in battleground states. Our media critic, John Carroll, joins us now to talk about the last-minute ad blitzes. And, John, what's jumping out at you?
Well, what jumps out is the mix of negative and positive ads. Traditionally, at this stage of the race, candidates tend to go mostly positive because they don't want any kind of negativity around their campaign, especially the backlash from it. Here we're seeing a mix of them, and I think that's unusual.
Well, let's start with some of the positive first. Barack Obama is in John McCain's home state, Arizona, with this ad. It's called Something.
Something's happening in America, in small towns and big cities. People from every walk of life, uniting in common purpose. Barack Obama, endorsed by Warren Buffett. And
it goes
Colin
on to talk
Powell,
about people choosing hope over fear, one nation, one people. But Obama is also running this ad that attacks McCain in Georgia and North Dakota, two red states. It's called Rearview Mirror, and it ties McCain to President Bush's economic policy.
Wonder where John McCain would take the economy? Look behind you. John McCain wants to continue George Bush's economic policies.
And there's Bush and McCain in the rearview mirror. So mixed message there.
The Something ad is a classic. It's the genre called I See an America. That is a very traditional, classic closer ad. It's running in Arizona, maybe a little bit as a way to tweak McCain, because Obama's close there, but he's not that close. Georgia and North Dakota, I think those ads are serious, trying to pick up some points, and also to try to make McCain defend himself in those states. Obama's redrawing this map in a way that's made it very difficult for McCain to allocate his money. It's a strategic thing as much as a message thing.
Well, staying just with the Obama campaign, they started running another ad nationally over the weekend after Dick Cheney endorsed McCain. Let's listen.
Barack Obama, endorsed by Warren Buffett and Colin Powell. And John McCain's latest endorsement?
I'm delighted to support John McCain, and I'm pleased.
And there's Dick Cheney. You know, there's a little bit of humor in this, but do you think the McCain campaign is thinking, why did Dick Cheney have to do the endorsement this weekend, or are they welcoming it?
I'm sure they wished he had stayed in his undisclosed location and gone fishing or whatever. The music shift is almost Hitchcockian in its ominousness. The Dick Cheney thing is like manna from heaven for Obama. I think he can use that all the way home.
Well, some might say the McCain side has some manna from heaven as well. The National Republican Trust Pact is running this ad, bringing up the Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
For 20 years, Barack Obama followed a preacher of hate and said nothing is right raged against our country.
Not God bless America! God damn America!
Now, John, some McCain supporters have said he should have done this much earlier, emphasizing Barack Obama's ties, even if they were former ties, to the Reverend Wright. But do you think in doing it, finally, is it a mistake this late in the game?
It's not McCain doing it, and I think that any splashback comes on him, not this PAC that's been formed by this former conservative journalist. And the PAC reportedly is spending about $6 million. There's a lot of downside to this. And I think when you get into religion, you get into a very sensitive area with people. And I think for the independents McCain is looking to attract, that's a sort of a toxic topic for them.
Well, John McCain is running this radio ad in Virginia, another must-win state. Let's listen.
Hello, this is Senator John Warner. Hampton Roads is home to the world's largest military facilities. Barack Obama's liberal colleagues in Congress announced they will cut defense spending by 25%.
Effective?
I think it will be effective. Virginia is a key state. If McCain can't win Virginia, I think he's got a lot of trouble. This goes right to bread and butter issues, and I think it's the right topic in the right place at the right time.
Well, because it's about the military, but it's about cuts in spending, so it touches on the economy. But McCain stays with his military service in an ad called Freedom, one of his final television ads. Let's listen.
I've served my country since I was 17 years old. And spent 5 years longing for her shores.
You know, the ad features images of McCain in a North Vietnamese prison camp. And some of his backers are saying, why didn't he go there sooner? You know, they feel this is a legitimately heroic story.
This is his I See an America ad. And he talks about don't just hope for a stronger America, vote for one. And I think what he's doing is trying to play off Obama's inexperience, his experience, and also his story as an American hero to try to generate last-minute support.
Well, and speaking of that, I can hear people saying, oh, why bother? Everybody's made up their mind. But, you know, we started the program with undecided voters. They're out there.
Undecided voters are part of the target of these ads. But the other part of the target is the base. Both of them need to fire up their committed supporters to make sure they turn out.
John Carroll, here and now, media critic and mass communication professor at Boston University. By the way, you can see the ads we spoke of at our website, here-now.org. John, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And we'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
So
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Keeping with our presidential theme today, we thought we'd spend some time on the Massachusetts-born, Harvard-educated John Adams. Not the second president, the Pulitzer Prize-winning American composer, same name. Here's a little of his opera, Dr. Atomic, about J. Robert Oppenheimer and the creation of the A-bomb. It's been a banner fall for composer John Adams. Dr. Atomic had its Metropolitan Opera premiere. There's an HD broadcast in movie theaters around the world this Saturday. And Adams has also published a memoir, Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. Well, given all that, we thought it would be a good time to reprise a conversation we had with Adams in the spring of 2007 when he returned to Harvard to receive the school's Arts Medal. We wanted to ask him about a story we'd heard that when he was at Harvard, his head was full of the modern composer Arnold Schoenberg, but the music of Jimi Hendrix was floating through dorm windows.
Hey! That happened so often that I can't remember a specific moment, but it was a kind of emblematic experience that I would be, you know, stuck in the bowels of the music department worrying about some very dissonant piece of European music that I actually had very little interest in, and then I would walk across Harvard Yard and hear this fantastic Dionysian powerful music of rock. And finally, you know, I one day just kind of came to and said, there's something wrong with this picture. You know, I really have to get away from this Eurocentric approach to classical contemporary music. So I got in the car and drove across the country to San Francisco to sort of seek my spiritual fortune, I guess.
Was there ever a thought that you might switch completely to Hendrix or one of those other sounds, that you might leave classical?
Never. Actually, no. I love the classical canon, and I always felt myself to be a composer of written music and music that would work within the format of orchestral and operatic literature.
So what would you say you actually did? I mean, it's very simplistic to say, and aha, you combined some of the sounds of the day with classical sounds.
I at first was a big follower of John Cage and did a lot of events in San Francisco that were very kind of free-form, messy, more philosophically interesting than aesthetically interesting. But I was searching for my own voice, and I think it finally came largely through just a general maturing, both of my musical technique and of my myself as a person. Also, in the mid-70s, I heard my first minimalist pieces. I heard pieces by Steve Reich and Philip Glass and Terry Riley, and that seemed to point in a really very, very fruitful direction for me.
By the way, for those who aren't followers, define that. What do you mean by minimalism?
Well, minimalism we use as a sort of blanket term to describe a music that's characterized by three things. One is that it has a very clear, stable sense of pulse. You know, you tap your toe to it. It has a harmonic sense, but the changes in harmonies tend to be very gradual. You might stay on a single harmony for, you know, minutes. And finally, it's a music that builds its large-scale architecture through reiteration or repetition of very small motives. But But I wanted the music that also was able to be much more dramatic, it could turn on a dime. So I wanted to find a music that had the energy of American culture, that had the pulsation, the life. Fundamentally, American culture, even to this day, compared to European culture, is still optimistic.
Tell us more what your early influences were. I mean, here we are at Harvard where, you know, you studied writing music, but what else was influencing you?
Well, I grew up in a really small town, East Concord, New Hampshire. There were about 300 people there, so I was very limited in my exposure to live music. I learned the canon through listening to LPs and collecting them. That's how I learned Beethoven and Stravinsky and Bartok and Ives. You know, I remember being in a local record store one day in New Hampshire and picking up this LP that had a beautiful scene of snow and pine trees, and that sort of looked like home. And it was a composer named Sibelius that I'd never heard of, but I thought, gee, if that looks like my backyard, maybe I'd like the music. So I bought it and took it home, and Sibelius, in fact, turned out to be an immensely important composer for me.
How do you feel about the current crop of young people studying to be composers? Are you encouraged? Because you just don't hear a lot in, popular press, you know, young people wanting to be composers. And I'm just wondering, is it out there?
It is absolutely out there. And one of the most aggravating and annoying phrases that I hear these days is the death of classical music. I just came here to Harvard from being at Yale, the Yale School of Music, and I heard performances of my music there that I can tell you without any hyperbole or exaggeration were among the best performances of my music I've heard anywhere in the last 30 years. And most interestingly, they're still interested in writing for orchestra, which I really was pronouncing a dead art form. I just didn't see the orchestra being a setting that would attract young composers who'd grown up listening to Radiohead and hip-hop. But in fact, there's a huge interest on the part of young people to continue the classical tradition. We call it classical not because we want to think of guys in wigs, but I call it classical because I want to think that what I do is going to be meaningful 100 years or 200 years from now. And that when somebody who does live 200 years from now listens to my music, they'll get the feeling of, that's what it felt like to be alive. It's through the arts that we create our culture. And when we want to think back over the history of the human species, it's through their art. I mean, when we think about the Mayans and we think about the Chinese and we think about all these cultures from a long time ago, it's through their art that we understand them.